Chapter 10. London, September 1918.
Foe suffers hardest blow of whole war. German high command flee to town near own frontier. The Times.
Eleanor sat at the back of the classroom and stared out of the window to a point beyond the quadrangle, past the netball courts and the hockey pitch, to a place under the trees where she imagined herself lingering with a book. Or perhaps just resting, her mind empty, vacant, without a single thought to bother her.
Eleanor White, you've been in the midst of yet another dream since you walked into my classroom, said Miss Doncaster, the mathematics teacher. Apply yourself, my girl. Apply yourself, or you will never complete the test.
Eleanor turned to face Miss Doncaster. She did not roll her eyes, but both she and the teacher knew she might as well have.
What do you have to say for yourself, White?
Eleanor pushed back her chair with an audible scrape and lifted the 6 sheets of paper handed out 45 minutes earlier to each of the 20 girls in the class. She stood up, proceeded to the front of the classroom, and handed the papers to the teacher. I finished.
Finished? Finished, mark my words. I do not appreciate sloppy work from any girl in my class.
Doncaster pronounced the word girl.
I will hold you to the highest standards of academic accomplishment.
I did not find the test particularly difficult, Miss Doncaster, said Eleanor.
Well, everyone else in this class admits to at least some difficulty with mathematics, so why you are any different is quite beyond me.
Eleanor offered no immediate response, instead waiting a second or two before voicing her request. Miss Doncaster, may I go to the library to read? I believe it will be a far better use of my time.
That's it!
Doncaster stood up and leaned forward, resting her knuckles on the desk before her.
Class, put your pencils down and pay attention. White, return to your desk.
Eleanor did as she was told, feeling all eyes upon her as she took her seat once again. Tempted as she was to fold her arms, she knew Miss Doncaster would interpret the gesture as an inflammatory action. Instead, she clasped her hands on her lap. Doncaster stepped out from behind her desk and looked from right to left, eyeing each of the 20 girls in the classroom.
Ladies, our country has endured 4 years of war. Though we hope there will be an end soon, it has not yet come. How many of you have lost your fathers to this war?
7 girls, including Eleanor, raised their hands.
And how many of you will never see your brothers again?
12 girls raised their hands.
How many of you have received news that a male relative has perished?
15 girls raised their hands, 12 of those raised both hands.
And finally, how many of you know of young men who have given their lives for our country, perhaps neighbours or friends of your brothers and cousins?
Every hand in the room was raised.
Ladies, look around this room at the show of hands. You may not realise it at this particular juncture, but you have before you a mathematical truth that only the most foolish will ignore.
Doncaster focused on Eleanor, who stared back.
Given what we know, and what is evident in your responses to every question I have put to you, the loss of life our country has sustained, notably the passing of young men in their prime, it would be fair to say that girls of your age, who are on the cusp of womanhood, will have only a 1 in 10 chance of marriage as time goes on. 1 in 10.
She paused, again looking from one girl to the next.
So, where does that leave you?
Doncaster did not wait for answers, nor did she show any indication of a willingness to listen.
That leaves you to prepare as best you can to make your way forward alone, which in turn means you will have to become responsible for your own financial security. Your future prospects are in your hands, and you must build a sturdy academic foundation for the years ahead, so you may forge connections, friendships, and the valuable associations that will carry you through your lifetime.
She glared at Eleanor again.
Miss White, are my calculations right? Given your mathematical prowess, I believe you should know.
Eleanor nodded. Yes, Miss Doncaster, your reckoning is correct. She did not blink as she answered the teacher. And to support your hypothesis, continued Eleanor, I believe women bereaved during the Boer War found themselves in similar circumstances, so their progress should be an example to us all.
Doncaster reddened and was about to say more when she was interrupted by another girl in the class.
Miss Doncaster,
said the girl, raising her hand.
Yes, Sophia Wallace, what is it?
Miss Doncaster, it's not only our brothers, cousins, and their friends who are dead. My sister, Delia, she was one of your pupils a few years ago. Well, she was killed while driving an ambulance in France.
The girl pulled a handkerchief from her sleeve.
So it's not only the boys we know who are gone.
Doncaster glanced at the ground.
Yes, of course. Delia Wallace excelled at physics and chemistry. First class, absolutely brilliant academics. Delia should have gone to Cambridge. I expect you to attain a place in her stead, Sophia.
She cleared her throat and began again.
However, I was simply making a point for the benefit of anyone who thinks they can swan through a vital test of accomplishment and ability. None of you can afford to be so cavalier.
She walked to the other side of her desk and checked the clock.
Continue with your test, in silence. And Miss White, given your swift progress, you may be excused to go to the library.
She sighed.
As may anyone else who has completed the test, every single question.
Thank you, Miss Doncaster, said Eleanor, gathering her books and pencil case and placing them in a brown leather satchel. As Eleanor reached the door, she heard another chair being pushed aside and footsteps moving toward Miss Doncaster's desk, but she did not look back. And she did not proceed to the library. Instead, she walked along the corridor, with its oak-panelled walls and polished parquet floors that smelled of lavender and beeswax, and upon reaching the main entrance, she left the building. She took neither bus nor train, but continued taking one step after the other until she felt pain from the effort from her feet to her head. She did not want to stop, and she did not want to talk to anyone as she made her way some 2 miles along the London streets to Kensington Gardens. Once there, she would find a quiet corner to be alone, avoiding the area that had been given over to the army, who had built trenches and dugouts and brought in sandbagging for the training of soldiers bound for the front. Alone had become Eleanor's preferred place, alone and away from her grandmother, with her suggestions and opinions that could only come from one who has been at home and safe, while others were at war. She wanted a rest from her mother, who had become a daughter again, since returning to live under her own mother's roof. Charlotte was often fussy, wondering aloud what might become of them all. Cecily had been persuaded to undertake a clerical course, but had left the secretarial school for young ladies in favour of teaching and perhaps employment as a governess. Who knew how long that would last? Eleanor thought it obvious that Cecily did not care for work at all, and would rather languish in their shared room all day worrying about herself, which caused more fussing from Charlotte, more arguments and more apologies. Oh, how Eleanor wished her father were there. He would temper her mother's moods and give Cecily the gentle push that in his clever way always worked with her sister. She wanted her beloved father home again. In truth, Eleanor was torn. She loved her family with a fierce protectiveness, but it left her weighed down by guilt that wrapped itself around her whenever she dreamed of being far away from this coterie of women among whom she just didn't seem to fit. Would it be too much for her mother and Ceci to grasp that no one can ever be ordinary, ever again, after they have killed a person? And she had killed 2 men. Eleanor dropped her satchel on the grass and lay on her back, eyes closed against the low autumn sun. It was predicted the war would be over soon, though she doubted that the moving pictures in her mind would vanish forever when peace was declared. And what about this restlessness she had felt since they arrived in London? It was a feeling inside her very spirit that nothing mattered, yet everything mattered, that she had to be on the move and could not tarry. If she stopped, what then? The more settled their situation, the more unsettled Eleanor became. And why were mathematics, geography, history, chemistry, English literature, and the study of everything else so important when she had derailed two locomotives, when she had crept out of her house in the blackness of night to count the carriages on a passing train, estimating the number of tanks, of cannons, of guns that might be on their way to the German army at the front? People had been slaughtered as a result of her actions. What might it take to calm her from the inside so she could be normal on the outside? And would anything ever be plain ordinary anymore? She pressed her fingers against her eyes as if to push away the torment.
There you are. I thought that was you.
Eleanor sat up, now a little dizzy, shielding her eyes with her hand and squinting to see who had spoken to her.
Sophie Wallace, what are you doing here?
The girl, wearing the same long navy blue tailored jacket, the same mid-calf-length skirt and white blouse with a navy blue tie, sat down beside Eleanor. She removed her brimmed turquoise blue hat with the darker grosgrain band bearing the school insignia and pulled pins from her red hair.
Same as you. Had to escape St. Joseph's Academy for Young Ladies and bored mathematicians.
How did you know where to find me? Sophie shook her head and ran her fingers through a cascade of sun-burnished chestnut curls.
I didn't. I just happened to see you.
She pointed to a place in the distance.
My brother was stationed here for a while, training over there before they sent him off to fight. I used to sneak out of school to meet him. I did it almost every day because I was scared I'd never see him again after he sailed for France.
Eleanor waited. The other girl shrugged.
And I was right. He was killed about a week after he landed,
said Sophie, who seemed to be sprouting more freckles in the sunshine.
Just 1 week.
You said you'd lost your sister too.
That's right, she smiled. There was a bit of a gap between Robin, Delia and me. I was the afterthought child or a mistake, depending on how you look at it. Now I'm the only one left.
That's terrible. Eleanor paused. My father was killed in Belgium.
You're originally from Belgium, aren't you? Your English is really good. You'd never know you're from over there.
My mother is English.
And I know you speak French and German. I've heard you rattling it off in class. Do you speak that funny Flemish language, too?
Eleanor nodded. And a fair bit of Italian. We had a lot of language lessons where I went to school.
That'll be useful, won't it? If Dopey Doncaster is right, you can get a position as a teacher.
Sophie, she's not so dopey. Miss Doncaster hit the nail on the head.
I suppose I should do some of that galvanising and think of something to do so I don't languish in a dark, dismal chasm of bored and bereft spinsterhood. Perhaps I could become a nurse, though my father will have a fit. I can see him now going on and on about how only poor girls go into nursing, that it's for young washerwomen. My mother would complain about what people might think. You should have heard them when Delia joined the first aid nursing yeomanry.
She shrugged.
Father just cannot grasp the fact that everything has changed. We shall never be the same, and I'm not going to languish at home waiting for a husband who will probably never come along. You're right, you can't argue with Doncaster's calculations on that one.
Eleanor nodded and they sat in silence for a while, both girls replacing their hats to protect pale skin from the warming sunshine.
What was it like in Belgium, Eleanor?
You'd never believe me if I told you.
Why not? I think I'd believe anything about this war now. Most of the women you see on the street are clad in black, and they're in some uniform or another and wearing a black armband, so you know they've lost someone. We're a land in mourning, women wrapped in widow's weeds.
Sophie sighed.
It's like that poem by Walter de la Mare. You know, we read it in English last week. Weeps she never, but sometimes sighs and peeps at her garden with bright brown eyes, and all she has is all she needs, a poor old widow in her weeds.
She pointed into the distance.
Do you know that every single one of the boys who was over there training with Robin was killed? Every single one, as Miss Doncaster would say. So yes, Eleanor, I would believe whatever you told me about Belgium.
Another time. Perhaps, said Eleanor, coming to her feet.
Are you going back to school now?
Sophie held out her hand toward Eleanor, who grasped it and helped her up from the damp ground.
No. Home?
No.
What will you do?
I think I'll just wander. Sophie regarded Eleanor, and without warning, opened her arms and embraced her.
That's for being honest. And for being brave.
Eleanor shook her head. I'm not brave, Sophie. If I were truly brave, I would go back to St. Joseph's. I think being a schoolgirl was in the past, even before I left Belgium. Walking away, Eleanor could feel Sophie's bright brown eyes upon her, but when she turned around, her classmate was making her way across the park in the direction of the training trenches, as if she might encounter the returning soul of her lost brother.
World war ends. Armistice in force. Hohenzollerns take to heels. Kaiser runs to Holland.
The Daily News, November 11th, 1918.
Just hold my hand so we don't get separated, Ceci, said Eleanor. Oh, look over there. The soldiers are jumping in and out of the water. Oh, my goodness. Look at them.
Eleanor felt Cecily clutch her hand as the crowd gathering at Trafalgar Square pressed in, laughing, drinking, happy beyond any measure since 11 that morning, when bells began ringing across the land to let everyone know that at last, after 4 long years, the armistice had come. Peace was declared. Soldiers from Australia and New Zealand were whisking up girls to dance around the fountain, and then the Canadians joined in, with more soldiers from across the British Empire taking the hands of anyone who was game to be part of a conga line. Eleanor looked at the men, women, soldiers, children, at the masses, converging in jubilant accord. Yes, she was relieved, happy. She was now 14 years of age, and though she was joyous at the news, there was another feeling she could not pinpoint. She had so much to be thankful for. They had escaped Belgium with their lives, given help along the way by strangers who risked so much to assist them. They were not poor in London, thanks to a number of diamonds taken one by one from their petticoats, and a grandfather who was clever with his money. Despite the near constant ache of grief and loss, Eleanor had done well at school since coming to England. It seemed the nuns in Belgium had given her a first-class foundation, so she was ahead in her studies. In time, if the gods remained with her, she would be bound for university with Sophie. It was later, as she walked with Ceci back to their home, joining in street parties along the way, that it came to her in an instant why she felt as if she were on the edge of a precipice. She still could not escape the truth that she had killed 2 men to protect her sister's honour. The act had saved both their lives, but didn't taking a life require atonement? If that were so, when would fate come for her? Where was her personal armistice? What might it feel like, and how would she know when she was free? Because that was her fear. That the piper must be paid, and war or no war, necessity or not, fate was coming to settle the account. Eleanor White returned to St. Joseph's for her final years at the school, and having made a friend, her first ever best friend, someone who was not her sister or mother, she felt as if she were following in Sophie's wake, learning from her, adjusting her ambitions as she became more familiar with academic life in England. Every day she seemed to become a little more English, with a greater understanding of what might be possible if you could negotiate society's structures, its opportunities and dead ends. It came as no surprise when Sophie announced she was bound for Newnham College, Cambridge. Eleanor had applied to Cambridge and was deemed the perfect candidate by no less than Miss Doncaster. She was therefore crestfallen when Charlotte objected and her grandmother complained, both suggesting that Eleanor should remain in London. Cecily said little, though Eleanor thought she didn't need to, her pout was enough. Yes, she could see that Ceci had been caught betwixt and between, as the saying went, and might feel as if opportunity had passed her by. There had been many new sayings to be learned since coming to London, aphorisms to describe this or that feeling or situation or someone's character. Ceci had indeed been betwixt and between. She was too old for St. Joseph's, and at first a little too young for the secretarial college. Though even her grandmother suggested the night schools, established decades earlier, when rural workers had flooded into London seeking employment in new factories being built alongside the river. The night schools offered opportunity to those who had been left behind by the circumstance of age, available funds, or their station in life. Ceci was slow to apply, and Eleanor knew why. She saw it on Armistice Day, when an Australian soldier grabbed her sister's hand to whisk her into a dance. There was a flash of panic writ large across Ceci's face, and in that moment Eleanor too was transported back to the path by the river in the dark. Though she carried only her jacket on that glorious Armistice Day, she could feel the pistol's weight in her hand. Eleanor and Sophie kept in touch, visiting one another throughout the years of their tertiary education. Eleanor's at the University of London, though those meetings became fewer when Eleanor won the opportunity for further study in Paris at the Sorbonne. Of course, there was no such offer without making an application, so this time Eleanor said nothing until her plans were set. Life beckoned. The future teased her with possibility. And she had an objective. She would make a life in Paris. The past was gone, and she had endured enough of the depression that had wrapped Britain in a cloud within days of the armistice, as if the people had overnight realized the dead weren't coming back. They were gone, never to return. As soon as she arrived in Paris, at the age of 22, Eleanor determined one thing. She would never, ever look back. She would remain in Paris and make a life for herself. Visits to see her family in London would be kept to a minimum. If she turned her head toward the past, she might see fate coming for her.